I'm Dr. Brent Schillinger, along with my colleague, Dr. Abby Strauss, and today we're talking with John Hewlett. John's official title is Senior Program Manager, the Office of Behavioral Health and Substance Use Disorders, Palm Beach County, more affectionately known as the Drug Czar of Palm Beach County. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Dr. Schillinger.
That title, Drug Czar, is that well-deserved, would you say?
Someone recently referred to me as evangelist. I kind of like that better than Drug Czar. Believe it or not, that the concept was birthed by Joe Biden in George Bush 1 with the establishment of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. So the director of that out of the White House was always referred to as the Drug Czar, the first one being William Bennett. That's where it was birthed. New Jersey was one of a number of states that followed that model. So there's a New Jersey State Drug Czar's office, of which I was appointed by Governor Christie, approved by the state Senate in New Jersey to lead that office in his administration. There's not many states now that have maintained that effort. There are probably one or two counties now that have established something similar.
So you came down to Palm Beach County in 2018 to become the Drug Czar after New Jersey. When you came down to Palm Beach County, what did you expect? What surprised you?
I don't know that there were many surprises, to be honest with you. I was, at the time, the New Jersey State Drug Czar, and my daughter, who we've been navigating her care since elementary school, quite frankly, early onset mental illness, subsequent substance use disorder, a number of other challenges along the way. Our first foray down into Palm Beach County, Southern Florida, was with her care. And I remember turning to my friends and colleagues at the time and saying, I don't know what is going on down there in Palm Beach County, but it's like the Wild West. We did not have a favorable experience with her and her care. I won't get into any great details other than having incredibly great distaste for this area, to be quite frankly. And there was a call, as I've been inspired many times before in my life, avocations, if you might, an inspiration to come to South Florida as I was trying to grow my consulting work. I literally, my retort back to my God at the time was, you want me to go to the belly of a beast? To what on God's earth could I potentially accomplish down there? Little did I know.
When you got down here in 2018, there are two questions that come to mind immediately. More or less, what was your mandate and how did it compare, or what could you carry from New Jersey and your experiences up there into Palm Beach County?
The mandate was very clear. It was an appointment by the Board of County Commissioners as Drug Czar to lead its opioid epidemic response efforts. At that time in 2017, as you know, there were certainly significant issues with pill mills and subsequently heroin overdose deaths, which reached its peak in 2017. The board adopted an opioid plan before I ever arrived here. One of the high priorities of that plan was to appoint a Drug Czar to coordinate and lead the effort. So that was the mandate. I took a look at the plan and quite frankly found it incredibly lacking. I had taken a very significant break from this field. I've been in it primarily in a policymaking capacity for 30 plus years. Came a point when I left Governor Christie's administration that I refused just completely to be in this field. I just needed to take a break. I would not take a treatment client. I ended up having a friend and colleague of mine back in New Jersey who heard me, frankly, complain quite a bit about the nature of the care that we've experienced and the others have experienced. And he says, well, you know, if you could do something different, what would you do? And he literally paid me on a consultant's basis to model out what was then a site level model of care that was largely non-clinical. When I came to Palm Beach County, I had that body of work and experience behind me for the prior 3 years. And so the real challenge for me at the time was, how do I take this site level familiarity and desire and translate that into much more of a systemic approach? I'll be honest with you, my first appearance before the board, I was really clear about the direction I was going. Was a few months after I was appointed. And I said, we are moving from a treatment-centered system of care to one person-centered and recovery-oriented. All of our work since then has been very much in establishing such a system.
Was there much resistance to you bringing in changes? As I've often visualized you, perhaps the teacher came into the classroom and saw that the students were playing and not studying.
I was really intentional. I understood that I was the new kid on the block. I think we can all agree that Palm Beach County suffered significant black eyes with respect to it being the epicenter not only of overdose deaths in the state, but also the epicenter of fraud and abuse nationally and in the industry. And I hate the use of that term industry as if we're dealing with widgets and not people. Nevertheless, I knew coming in, I would need to undertake a tremendous educational effort. So I was very clear when I started my job, I was not going to sit behind the desk. I coined it my community immersion. I was going to go out and hear concerns, referred somewhat to the opioid response plan. At the same time as I was listening, I was also educating about how we could do things differently as we move forward toward longer term recovery outcomes.
So out of curiosity, who were you educating? Who was your audience?
Whomever would invite me. Literally, if you looked at my annual report the first year I was here, I was at 300 plus meetings in my first year alone. It didn't matter whether it was evening, weekend, whatever. I never said no to a meeting, community members meeting with providers. And frankly, where my heart really rests and where I identify most is with parents struggling with children with co-occurrence or substance use disorder and parents of loss. The most difficult conversations, quite frankly, are always with the parents of loss who inevitably, almost to the person, would talk about, well, maybe, just maybe, that next treatment stay would be the one that have been successful. And it's always difficult to respond back, well, maybe not so fast. How about if we talked about what was lacking, not only in the care, but more importantly, the discharge from the acute care? Then you could see the wheels starting to spin about, oh my gosh, yeah, this didn't happen. We were told this was going to happen and it didn't. Issues of employment and housing, we were left holding the bag and having to pay cash out of pocket, those types of things. So I identify most strongly with parents of loss. And we've witnessed here in Palm Beach County, particularly with the recent policy change, Sheriff Bradshaw, they can be a really effective force when directed and energized for particular policy objectives.
It goes in many ways to the old saying that politics is local. And when people locally start to do things, I've been down in Florida many years. And historically, we always rank 47th, 48th, 49th in the nation in terms of providing mental health care. And a big chunk of, in my opinion, and I'm looking forward to listening to your opinion, a big chunk of it is that treatment facilities, and we had some good ones. There certainly we had some excellent ones, but they really didn't focus on what was causing the addiction problems in the first place. You spoke of getting a job and all the follow-up things. Why do you think this happened here with such intensity? And what's, if you could be as specific as you can, what has changed and what has your office done? Help us understand the good work that you're doing in specifics.
Absolutely. So what happened was, as we saw, first alcoholism was a covered illness via insurance. Door was kicked down and all kinds of fraud and abuse. I mean, that really then introduced managed care and a lot of tightening in terms of acute care. And then we saw the passage of federal parity, and we also saw the passage of the Affordable Care Act, which absolutely opened the doors and the floodgates of revenue to providers that had no experience in the space and all of a sudden were CEOs and owners who saw a lot of cash. That, in my belief, was what happened, and it led to a lot of fraud and abuse. In terms of what we have done specifically, I think very clearly, as many have witnessed the work, we first and foremost set a vision for the county, just adopted through our steering committee an update of the 2017 plan. We did that in March, and that just embodied a lot of the work that we've laid forth and planned for and developed and executed over the last few years. And primarily, that is to establish a readily accessible and integrated person-centered recovery-oriented system of care. That's part and parcel of the systems model that we now have in place. All of my policy and funding and budgeting decisions are through that lens. People look at the various initiatives that we've undertaken throughout my tenure here and see them almost in isolation. I don't view any of our efforts in isolation. I view them as very much pieces to the puzzle. So we've, the underpinnings of it most tangibly of this system is a network of recovery community organizations and centers throughout the county. Now, the provider will try and convince you that length of stay is the predictor to long-term recovery outcome or one of them. It's not length of stay. The research is length of engagement. And although we talked about this recovery-oriented system of care for 20 years, the reality is 95% of federal expenditures of the $6 billion that the feds are spending in this arena is expended on acute care. And that's true at the state level, and it's true at the county level. The lower cost, softer interventions produce much more improved recovery, long-term recovery outcomes. Just a fact.
When you first came here to Palm Beach County, I remember having a conversation with you, and Jersey running the state, it was something like a $200 million a year budget or something like that. And Palm Beach County, not quite the same. Between that and the fact that we didn't have Medicaid expansion in Palm Beach County, how has this been an obstacle?
From a policy objective is to say we need more money or expand treatment capacity. And here's how you expand capacity. You expand capacity stopping the same individuals from returning to acute care. It's absolutely possible. I've seen it happen. I've seen the revolving door relapse back into treatment be closed. When you neutrally assess a person's care, as evidenced by what we've achieved in New Jersey with a 25-plus year program, only 16% of expenditures are on the acute side of the equation. The rest is IOP or OP. I learned from the New Jersey work, we have to look beyond just any clinical intervention into how do we engage and provide softer supports in the community. We are achieving that through development and expansion of these community centers. The main thing is, well, how do you prove it works? When you have an aim or a goal in government, we want to be able to measure it. Right? We measure through what we call recovery capital indexing, which is a validated survey instrument that looks at the wellness and key predictors to long-term recovery outcome. We've deployed that instrument. We require its use through our behavioral health contracts now. Frankly, the only other measure historically that's been, and it's a total failure, is successful treatment discharge, which tells me nothing. Here's the reality. You look at the data, the ratio of successful treatment discharge is somewhere between 50 and 60%. If I came home with a 50 or 60 from school, I was in trouble. But somehow we want to deem that a success.
You bring up such a good point because years ago, many years ago, I worked for some government agencies helping with this. The story was if one agency got $1 million to deal with overdose cases in the hospital, at the end of the year, they can give you some statistics. If another agency got $1 million and their job was to go into schools and teach coping skills, ego structures and stuff like that, who's going to have data at the end of the year? Not the teachers. You never know how many people you helped. And that's the problem. I think part of the problem, and I'm glad you're talking to this because I think it's critical, it's where so much of the system fails that could succeed, is that we're not recognizing that there is a reason why these people gravitate, drift, migrate, whatever word you want, into substance abuse. And that can't be fixed in 30 days. And then you have a whole entrepreneurial group. The people who are making and selling the fentanyl are exploiting vulnerabilities and the propensities of these poor people. And we don't spend enough on the preventative mental health and the restorative mental health. And this is why, if in my opinion, so glad to hear what you're talking about, is that if somebody goes to AA, the first month is really important. It's the first year that counts. It's 2 years that counts. And we're not providing that in most of our formal treatment modalities.
Therein lies the point, right? That we have to pivot from this mindset of treatment intervention. And I am absolutely not anti-treatment. I'm a believer in mutually assessed, appropriately determined levels of care, and then having entity eyeballing longitudinal perspective of a person's care. And I call it care, not treatment, because I know at some point from an engagement perspective, it's likely an individual is not going to be engaged in a clinical intervention. Look, I am a person in long-term recovery, 36 plus years. I've succeeded in self-support. I've witnessed others. And if people succeed in that realm, of course, I'm going to be very happy for them. The issue is those people like myself that go back into society and contribute to it, we have no idea. I think we all admit we don't have any longitudinal data to speak of. You know, we don't have anything at 6 months out, or except for self-report. reports by treatment providers say we have a 95% success rate. Based on what measure? And you even said earlier, there are good treatment providers. I'm not saying that there aren't, but by what measure? You know, so when we have a neutral platform like we do in the recovery capital indexing, which is substance agnostic, it doesn't factor in yay or nay use. It's just factoring in a multitude of factors that we know contribute to long-term recovery. You ask, is it a challenge? Of course it is, yeah. But people are used to the status quo. People don't like change. It can be very frustrating at times, but when you have a vision, you have a systems model, you have a constituency and community members and other stakeholders that are invested and want to see this happen for the benefit of residents in Palm Beach County, that's a far cry from where we were. I tell you, if you look at the 17 response plan, it was woefully lacking in the discussion of long-term recovery. The word recovery didn't even appear in the plan.
With this concept of recovery capital index, what type of data have we seen pertinent to Palm Beach County?
Yes, we have seen incredible data. Again, we required amongst our behavioral health contracts now, as well as our recovery community centers, and our outcomes now for our behavioral health providers require baseline recovery capital. That recovery capital survey has to inform a individualized recovery plan, which is separate from a treatment plan. Treatment needs are different than recovery plan needs. They also are measured on successful handoff to a recovery community organization. We then have that data that literally follows a person being engaged at a recovery community center. So we've had well over 2,000 survey responses. We have a 95% completion rate, which is just phenomenal. We find is frankly what we would expect on the key predictors of long-term recovery outcomes, i.e. employment, housing stability, financial well-being, those areas, they were our lowest indicators. Our highest indicators are what really, frankly, what we call our cultural capital domain. And that is a set of core values and beliefs that sustain people, community engagement, which is an absolute key predictor. And it's just really fascinating. And what I get to do at the macro level is to take this data and start to make the arguments about why are we funding acute care when, in essence, we can manage someone's care, keep them out of the revolving door back into deep end care, free up those dollars to expend on those predictors that we know will lead to long-term recovery outcome.
The media looks at one statistic, which is overdose deaths. And they go, oh my gosh, they're going up. You know, we have all these great programs. It looked like things were getting better. Now they're actually worse than ever. Is that because maybe they're not really looking at all the measures, that there's a lot more to look at than just overdose deaths?
When we passed our resolution, we were very clear to resolve that we would prefer to see zero deaths, but knowing that that's not realistic. One death is too many. When I started here and we were touring various arms of county government and the medical examiner's office, of course, Dr. Bell was here at that time. James Green, our director of community services, asked if we could see the facility. Dr. Bell looked at his watch and said, well, you know, there shouldn't be a body on the table at this time of the day. It was about 11 o'clock in the morning. And as soon as we banged her right into this very sterile autopsy room, there was a 20-year-old newly overdosed male. I can never shake that, just knowing it. That one magnified by how many.
When I was working in South Carolina, we had a reasonably good working relationship with vocational rehabilitation. How much is your office mandated, or can you even, it may not be part of your mandate, to be political and to help really make parity better and to make insurance be at least reasonable in terms of paying for long-term care, because those are real obstacles. Very often, and I'm echoing what you said, they get out of detox, but where do they go? When we didn't get the Medicaid expansion, that really choked us. And we have hospitals, they come and they go and they come and they go, and some are good, some are not. We need help from this side of the desk in being able to properly fund the services that are necessary to provide the assistance to these people so they can get some sense of connection in life, so they can get some sense of spiritual or cultural or whatever works. So my big circle and my long and complicated question, I apologize. What do you, can you do, perhaps you can't, in terms of being an advocacy for these elements?
Well, evangelist and advocate are somewhat, you know, synonymous. Yes. So, you know, and here's just the reality. And it's one of the things that our plan update points to. The 17 plan pointed to these spheres of siloed interest that, quite frankly, had not been repaired in my time here, not for lack of effort. You know, they still exist. And the plan did recommend, beyond the appointment of a drug czar, the need for the designation of a lead entity to coordinate all of these efforts. That was somewhat perceived to be my role. But the reality is that my role is singly that. It is a position within county government. It is not an authorized by ordinance office where there's statutory authority to do this. That matters. So one of the recommendations you find in the plan is that the board needs to consider that, because there are still these spheres of siloed interest, and they're going to remain. But there should be an entity that's looking across these various influence spots and their funding, and you begin to weave that together with some authority. I think we've taken a step with our work on the master plan update. There's a lot left to be done. I think our great contribution has been to articulate and begin to execute a vision, and viewing our work as very much pieces to the puzzle, where the persons at the center, these various services exist, many of them, that don't have to be paid for. The issue is, even though we're funding a lot of care coordinators in the acute setting, they're not connecting these folks to community resources. They are often calling people out in the community saying, hey, can you help? The role is to ensure that an episode of care, and again, I'm going with care, not just treatment, longitudinally care, that these pieces to the puzzle are made accessible to an individual. I mean, look what we've done. We expect newly recovered individual to navigate this stuff all by their lonesome. I tell you, I'm long-term in recovery trying to navigate my daughter's care, a man in this field, and had resiliency factors, and it almost killed me. And then when someone does happen to lapse, for whatever reason, the stressors of it, we stigmatize our own, that somehow they have done something wrong, rather than asking critically, how has the system not cared for them and addressed their needs in a way that they didn't feel the need to lapse? Yeah, this is complicated. It's multifaceted. There is not a singular answer.
The notion of the silos is a very good graphic to keep in one's mind, because at my office, I'll say several times a week, people call looking for help, asking why aren't more doctors and social workers and psychologists taking their insurance. Part of the problem is that the insurances do not pay realistic amounts to offset the cost of a private practice. That's why I'm so vocal about this, because I'm delighted what you're doing. I think the word that you used at the very beginning, that you're educating the legislators, other people in town, they're having to think about this problem and not be, what's a good word, not be convinced so easily that good intentions convert to clinical reality. There's a lot of dirt in between, but it's navigable dirt. I'm saying this and you can hear my frustrations, and I'm also applauding you for your work. How can we work together better? How is the treatment community responding to you, the medical community, the mental health community? Have they embraced you?
The medical society was the first in Florida to step up on this issue and has maintained that position and posture throughout my time here. And I applaud the medical society for that. One of my hopes and is a much more robust presence of experts bringing brief intervention referral to treatment into the primary care space. I understand very clearly why primary care docs don't want to do that screen, because the inevitable question is, well, what do I do with my patient now? Where do I refer them? Because I haven't really pressed until we have that single point of contact neutral care assessment entity. The doc gets the screen, they get reimbursed for it, either private or public sector. Then that handoff is a ready-made handoff. Here, call this number, make an appointment. They're going to do a deeper screen, and boom, off we go. Imagine that system, right? The question is, do providers that have historically the only way to access care is through a provider's door? Well, do you think they want to give up that access? and have their dollars managed in a way that's prior authorized, and payments are similarly, authorized based on whether you've addressed the needs of the client rather than whether you've applied your cookie cutter for that you've done for the last 40 years. You know, I'm sounding maybe a little bit harsh, but I think some of it is true. But that vision, and we know it would be to the betterment of citizens of Palm Beach County, we know it would save resources, and we know it would improve care, and it would improve COVID outcomes. Now, who wouldn't want that?
Recently, the governor announced a statewide program, this coordinated opioid recovery. Is that going to create another silo, or is this an opportunity for a lot of the ideas that we formulated here locally to take effect?
Honestly, when you look at the ROSC environment, I look at it as those types of initiatives as not being the center of a wheel, but a spoke in the wheel. Look, and you know this, I see we have more strict medical modelists, we have harm reductionists, we have the kind of middle of the road folks that are, I'll call them status quoists, for lack of a better word. Then I laid out a vision that said we can do better, we can create this system with a single point of contact and measure outcome and retool a system much to the betterment of the citizens.
Do you think your work will ever be complete anytime soon?
Well, from your lips to God's ears. I said recently to someone, I want to retire in Palm Beach County. He said, John, you live here. I said, no, I want to retire here. So will the work ever be complete? I don't know. I've been, as you well know, in the policymaking arena for a lot of years. What we've experienced in overdose deaths here and nationally doesn't change the system. It should have changed it already. And we should ask ourselves why it hasn't. Look at the response to 9/11. Look at the response to COVID and the trillions of dollars. Yet we still limp along. Geez, how about another $5 billion for treatment?
Why do you think this is so in our culture? Is it discriminatory? Is it some sort of racist thing? Is it some sort of shaming people? I don't have the answer myself. I have ideas, but I don't have the answer. You're closer to it policy-wise. Why do you think we're still having so many of those problems?
Because I don't know that anyone has really ever challenged the status quo or offered an alternative that could be and would be much more successful. So we default to what we know best, even though the evidence is it's performed poorly. I've talked about our expectations at that level of care for outcomes. If you really view acute care as a stem to bleeding moment, what measures would we want to do? Do we want to see reductions in suicidal ideation? The measures that would equate to, oh, this person is stable versus, oh my, we ran them through our cookie cutter and we successfully discharged them. And we've only done that to 60% of the folks that came through our door. Hey, let's call that a success. I don't know. It baffles me. And understand, for 16 years before I joined Governor Christie, I did all the public affairs and policy. He worked for the National Council on Opioid and Drug Dependence, New Jersey. Anything regulatorily in the state of New Jersey, I had my fingerprints on, and a lot federally. And I was very successful in the more treatment, policy objective. I could look at $250 million in new treatment money in the state of New Jersey. And when I started to navigate my daughter's care, I literally had a consciousness crisis. This is what I've been navigating for my whole life? What was I thinking?
Clearly, it's an ongoing process. It's an evolving process, and it's not going to be over anytime real soon.
It won't, but there is hope with the energies of you and Abby and many others put their support behind this. And part of that support has to translate into political support. Let's be real, because we are challenging certain silos. We are challenging funding streams. We are challenging certain decision makers and folks that have benefited from a system that stayed status quo.
John Hulick is drug czar for Palm Beach County. John, thank you so much for joining us.